Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We have a lot to go through, so I'm going to try to get through it. First off, I got to kind of explain yesterday. Technically, yesterday was Monday's show, but what happened, and so we have like this, I have to click on a button before a certain point in time, and if I don't, yesterday's show will go, because dead airspace in radio is death. So what we ended up happening is I ended up missing that, and that's happened once before, and it's just really tight, but when you're really preoccupied with a lot of things, like I've told you before, I've got a lot of personal support and so forth that I'm providing with other people. And so anyway, I ended up missing my little clicking on that button. So long story short, we ended up having to replay Friday on Monday. So today is technically Tuesday's show, but we're actually acknowledging the fact that we have a Wednesday show for Tuesday. Anyway, we have recorded, we've done a pre-recording with Dr. Vile, and we were going to read the Declaration of Independence that was originally written by Thomas Jefferson. And what we're going to do is we are going to provide you the words that he read and then point out the words that were deleted, so that when we read those things, and this, by the way, this word was deleted, and then we kind of lay it out for you so that you can hear the contrast of what Jefferson said and how political correctness kind of softened it a little bit. I mean, there were still, you know, very pointed expressions that were in the Declaration of Independence regarding King George and so forth, and even Dr. Vile points that out, but it was political correctness even back then. That comes down to politics. Unfortunately, there's this thing called compromise to getting things done, and that was the nature of politics then, as it is today. Politics is in everything. I've said this so many times before. And we have to understand that we're not in the shoes of the framers. We're not in those shoes of those men that had to make those compromises and make those decisions. Bottom line is, we do know this, that they did create some levels of protection for government and for our future. One of those is ex post facto laws. Because I know there's a lot of people today that are looking to make hay out of some of the things that the framers had to compromise on. Some of those compromises were unconstitutional. Now, if you want to go after those people and try them so you can dig them up and burn them in effigy, okay, you know, that's one thing. I mean, I would just recommend you get over it. But I understand that there are some people that, you know, just that's not good enough. They're incapable of forgiving and moving on. They want their pound of flesh. So, you know, okay, well, we'll have to let them, you know, state their case and let the politicians compromise on who they get to dig up and who they get to burn in effigy. But bottom line, this goes down to the concept of ex post facto laws, that we can't all of a sudden say, hey, this is now illegal, and so you committed a crime back then. No. And this whole concept of reparations is going down that exact same path. These are the concepts of ex post facto laws to say, hey, you know, slavery is illegal. It's a human violation. It's a civil rights violation, blah, 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 blah. I'm sorry. But at that point in time, it was the law of the land of those states. These were state laws. It wasn't something that was, it wasn't embedded in the Constitution. There were some protections from the slave states becoming too powerful, and there were some protections of what they called their property. Bottom line, going down this path of reparations is tantamount to calling for an ex post facto law, to say that that was something that was illegal. Slavery was a scourge upon the earth for 5,000 years. And if you've listened to this show, you've heard me say this many times, that slavery has been around so long that if somebody wants to say, okay, let's start paying for reparations, I think Egypt and Africa owes Israel a lot of reparations. If you want to actually have that nobleness about you. But what's really happening is people don't care about really trying to make things right. What people are trying to do is they're opportunists trying to take advantage of the divisive nature of these hacks that are in the political fray, that are out there trying to lead this charge in saying, we demand reparations for this. That is political hay, that's divisive, and these people are idiots. They don't understand what the heck is really, what the truth is, what's going on. And I hope you and I, at least you know as well as I do, that this is all just a scam, just try to get more money out of the political purse, and I should say the public purse, where we have to put this burden on taxpayers. Are you kidding me? Enough. Enough. If you don't start demanding compliance to the Constitution, because you know what? All of these wackos that are calling for reparations, all of these wackos that are calling for socialism, Medicare for all and everything else, your word should be enough. And the final word that you have to say is compliance. We demand compliance to the Constitution. And the only way we're going to get there is if we exercise republic review. We're running out of time. We're running out of time, and I could say this every day. We're running out of time. What's it going to take to get you there? We need to get there. So there's many things that you can do, and we go through those things on a daily basis of those things that can be done. So we'll highlight those again. But please remember this, that this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org, and that this is the only show. This is the only show that actually has the solution to shut down all of these idiots like Sharpton and the rest of these guys that have been taking advantage of all of these divisive windows that the progressives have put into the federal government that's all unconstitutional. They're using these things against us, and it's all unconstitutional. They're actually standing on a house of cards, and all we've got to do is just expose the fact that none of those cards are constitutional, and we blow them down, and what will happen is everybody will have to go and find a new source of cheese. It's done. The cheese is gone, buddies. And so is this pathway for globalism. We want compliance. We want to preserve our liberty, our individual liberty and individual sovereignty. We do not need to surrender to government all of our liberties so that they can save the stupid planet that isn't in peril from mankind. And so the listen line is 605-562-4209 or 605-313-0599. Now, I'm going to get into more on the myth of nullification in the next hour because I've barely got a little over 2 minutes now. So I'm not going to be getting into any of the wrap-ups and any of the G. Edward Griffith's need-to-know news. We'll probably have to cover that next week. But what I am going to do is on Friday, I will be reading the Declaration of Independence that Jefferson had written. So on Thursday for Independence Day, and as you understand, Independence Day is actually the 2nd of July because that's the day that they voted for it. And so they really didn't get all the signatures. There's really nothing special about the 4th of July, really, other than the fact that that's when I think they started printing things. Bottom line, what we need to know and what we need to understand is really how Jefferson had felt. And I mean Jefferson and the rancor he put into the original Declaration of Independence and the finger he used to poke in King George's eye. Well, they had to withdraw that finger. They coiled it back up and they kind of softened it up. But the parchment was still nice and pointy to poke into Britain's eye. Needless to say, we'll get into that on Friday. But what we do need to get into real quick is the ways you can get involved. You can buy the coffee from Red State Coffee. Just go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and click on the Red State Coffee link. If you want to directly support us, we have our crowdfunding. We do need your help, and we need direct help. So send me an email, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org, and you can get involved at your county, state level, or whatever. Let's talk. Let's find out what you can do. It's time. It's time, my friends, to start actually getting involved. I would also want to say that Constitution Day is coming up. It's around the corner. So please start getting hot and let us know what you want to do. We want to thank you for tuning in, and we beseech you to please let other people know that this show actually is different. I'm not an entertainer. I actually am going to talk about the actual solutions to the constitutional crisis and the constitutional crisis that we're living in and all of the problems and how to actually put them at bay with Republic Review, with auditing the Constitution and having the states take over and taking back their powers. Anyway, we're going to be back and we're going to get into the nullification and interposition positions as soon as we get back. So God bless, and we'll be right back after this. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in, and let's get on with the dialogue.
As I always do, there is no sign that the federal government is going to disband any of its tyrannical roles, responsibilities, and powers. So that means it's going to be left to us. If we do not do this, we will lose this. Now, some people may be pretty happy with the fact that we're living under a statist environment. But any of you who have a taste and have experienced liberty, you are going to find a serious problem with what the heck's going to be happening
when we get to that point where the globalists say, well, you know, we're going to let you have this, we're going to let you have that, but we're not going to let you have all this stuff anymore because you guys were out of control. When the fact of the matter is, it wasn't that we were out of control. It was our government, our sovereigns, that we never reeled in. They don't have these powers. We have to exercise the powers that the states possess over the Constitution and call them out because they have been violating their jurisdiction. They've been violating the Constitution in so many different ways. The Supreme Court can't even fathom this. They can't fathom. They believe that this creeping along, it's all okay. Even the conservatives on the Supreme Court, I think that it would really take a shock to the system for lots of people who have embraced this ideology of a living document, that they have the ability to legislate from the bench. I mean, come on, really? Now, maybe some of them might be kind of in that space, but the concept, they've never, ever heard them once utter the words, hey, we are well outside our jurisdiction, and you, hey, states, you need to get involved and peel all of this stuff back. If you don't, you will rue the day because we are going to break this republic. Anyway, so what I was reading yesterday and where I left off was I had kind of gone through some highlights, just a few highlights of the ratification debates that clearly pointed out that the federal government was enumerated powers within the Constitution, that it was an enumerated Constitution, not a general Constitution. We did not need a Bill of Rights. That the federal government's jurisdiction was limited to those enumerated powers and or to those constitutionally ratified treaties and or amendments, and that is it. Nowhere did we ever sign a treaty with another government to say that, you know, Medicare for all, or even to create Social Security or Medicare or any of these things, that the majority of what our funding is going on and what the funding has been spent on is unconstitutional government. But let me get back into what Marshall had said last, because he was the last quote that I read. And this is out of the Virginia ratification debates. And he says, and he asks a few questions, and they're rhetorical, but I'm going to answer the rhetorical questions that he asks. Has the government of the United States power to make laws on every subject? Absolutely not. It does not. It only has the powers to make laws under those things pursuant in the Constitution, as the Constitution says, which means only the enumerated powers do they have that power. Does he understand it so? And he's talking about this idiot that says, oh, they can make any of these laws and they can do anything. These were the anti-federalists trying to aggrandize the powers that the Constitution was giving. And they're all clearly stating the exact same thing. No, it doesn't grant any other powers other than these enumerated powers. Can they make laws affecting the mode of transferring property or contracts or claims between citizens of the same state? Absolutely not. Can they go beyond the delegated powers? No, 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 they can't. As a matter of fact, Madison said it, and there's just a plethora of framers, or I should say testimony within the ratification debates of these legally binding, constitutionally binding documents that says no, they cannot. They only have the powers to make laws under those enumerated powers. They have to be tied directly to those enumerated, but they can't make these, you know, two square leaps to go, okay, well, because we have the power to possess land for these very specific reasons, that means we can possess all land for anything we want. No, you can only possess the land for these very specific reasons. So if they were to make a law, this is Marshall again, if they were to make a law not warranted by any of the powers enumerated, it would be considered by the judges as an infringement of the Constitution, which they are to guard. They would not consider such a law as coming under their jurisdiction. So what the heck happened? And I'm here to tell you that lawyers, can't be trusted because they'll all want to pull it under them. Because, you know, every time they work on a case, guess what? They get paid. They get paid money. And so it is a self-interest thing for them to ensure that they have all of these things within their purview so they can make more money. And I'm sorry, folks. They don't have that right. They don't have that power. They don't have those abilities. Obviously, many of Marshall's rulings were contradictory to his testimony here. In the cases he reviewed, though, the verdicts were correct. What he uttered utterly contradicted what he said here. In other words, when he said that the federal government is supreme in all things, he was wrong, and he was contradicting himself and all the rest of the Federalists or the framers that were testifying to the limitations of the Constitution. So which of his words are correct? Obviously, there's only one. And that is the words, the only set of words that Marshall uttered that were actually constitutionally founded that we can stand on were the words he used to sell the contract, because the words he used after the contract was bought into is all felonious, it is all fake and all lies, because at that point in time he was self-aggrandizing. And, you know, so those of you who, like I mentioned earlier, if you there's people you want to dig up and bury, you know, burn in effigy, maybe Marshall might be one of those. Because as we talked with Doug Gibbs, I believe I had him on about 6 months ago or so. And in one of his books, he talks about, you know, the seven worst people who done more damage to the Constitution than anybody else. John Marshall was one of them. And you could probably get Douglas Gibbs' book and look at it. And I'm telling you that you will find that those seven people probably deserve to be dug up and, you know, burned in effigy if you're, you know, if you're really looking for, you know, taking it out on somebody. I say it's time to, you know, get over it. Let's move on. Let's take our powers back and let's get on with fixing problems. This problem is there's way too many people that are self-vested in making money off of this. That's your conservative entertainers out there. That's these organizations that are fighting for relevance, like the John Birch Society. There's lots of groups that are not willing to actually look at objective ways of solving the problem, because the problem is the goose that is laying the golden eggs. Because it's getting you to be infuriated and you to go, well, what do we got to do? And they say, well, give us money. We'll go take care of this. Oh, okay, here you go. And all the time, we've been creeping down this path of communism. We're knocking at the door of global communism today, my friends, because of some of these organizations that have been self-serving. Now, I've told you that there are organizations that are not self-serving, that they are independent thinking, and that they're actually looking at Republic Review, Eagle Forum being one of them. But let me move on. So the only thing that matters, basically, is what was said when the Constitution was defined at the time of ratifications. These are the only legal definitions that can be used, just as all contracts, within the bounds of contract law. This is why Marshall has become one of the most nefarious framers with Alexander Hamilton. Both use duplicity, and I'm telling you, when I talk to Dr. Vile, you will hear, you know, he takes a kinder position. I mean, I'm more like Jefferson. I mean, I'm willing to poke people in the eye. I'm willing to call some of these guys really bad guys. And Marshall was one and Hamilton was another. And so both used duplicity and soothsaying to obtain the changes they were seeking. Marshall created in these landmark decisions, Marshall created what I call unconstitutional footings for people to build upon later, using powers that were not ever granted within the Constitution, such as case law and precedent. Anyway, Marshall was a self-admitted protege of Hamilton, as pointed out by Russell Kirk in his book, The Conservative Mind, From Burke to Eliot. You should read that book. It's a very good book. Marshall's damage to the Constitution as defined came in these hallmark cases. And these are the cases I might have mentioned before. Marbury v. Madison. This is where they actually started. There's nowhere in the Constitution. Now, there is a level of protection, separations of powers, and so forth, and oversight. But there's nowhere where the federal court has the ability to reach down and basically say, hey, we want to take a look at this case. Because the Marbury v. Madison case was not a case that had jurisdiction to go to the federal court. So they reached down to grab something to actually make, use it for an agenda so that they could aggrandize their power. And in doing so, they aggrandized their power in granting themselves the ability to reach down into cases of inferior courts to help make rulings. And that's how they've been moving us along in the wrong direction. But we're at a hard break. We'll be right back after this. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's, and if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
So this Marbury v. Madison case was settled in 1808. The genesis of it happened in 1800 when, actually, I think it was 1801, in the midnight hours, it was called the Midnight Judges, when Adams, who received a whole bunch of, you know, appoint these people to the courts by Alexander Hamilton, and Adams, like the lapdog for Hamilton. I think Adams was intimidated by Hamilton because Hamilton was a very smart and shrewd man. Anyway, he appointed Marbury to a federal court, and Madison denied him of that. And so they basically took that to court, and they said, hey, you don't have a right to this. And there was really no jurisdiction for that local court. Bottom line, what ended up happening was Marshall pulled it up, and he reviewed it. And even though he said, we don't have jurisdiction, he created the precedents that the federal courts, so that the Supreme Court now had the ability to pull in cases. If you read the Constitution, the court does have a right of oversight over other parties, but they do not have an active right. They have to be pursued. In other words, somebody has to bring a case to them. They have to be passive. They do not have the ability to be activists. And that is the real problem that I believe came out of Marbury v. Madison. Another problem that came out of that was property rights to a federal job. And that is just absolutely insane. And these things need to be overturned completely. Fletcher v. Peck in 1800 was another one. And Sturgis v. Crown and Shield in 1819. Dartmouth College v. Woodward in 1819. That was about a contractual law. McCulloch v. Maryland was about the bank. And Cohen's v. Virginia, 1821. And Gibbons v. Ogden in 1824. And I think that was about ferrying and interstate businesses, as I believe they were ferrying transports and commerce across the river from New York into New Jersey. Long story short, in each of these cases, Marshall's opinions were hoodwinking the self-aggrandizement of the federal government and supporting the principles of centralizing powers. What he used in his babbles were these portals that were called the clauses or mystical clauses, the supremacy clause, the necessary and proper clause, the commerce clause, and the general welfare and defense clause. Never was there an intent. And Madison and the framers clearly stated that they could not use those outside the enumerated powers. But Marshall actually was out there stating that, oh yeah, we can do it if we believe it's necessary. And that is an outright lie. So he was hoodwinking the government folks in both the state as well, because the state was equally culpable. The reason Madison and other framers never wrestled with Marshall was his rulings were correct and his opinions were just opinions. Madison and the framers knew the Constitution gave no allowance for case law or precedent. The Constitution was a hard, fast compact, and that the only way it could be altered would be through the Article 5 process. That was it. So what Marshall was trying to do was Marshall was actually trying to create powers that they didn't have, but he didn't technically create the powers. He created the footings for people to come along later and actually start making the same assumptions that they could. That, oh yeah, well, Marshall stated this, and so this means that we can do these things. No, no. Either it's in the contract or it's not in the contract. It's not because he rambled on as a babbling old man and self-aggrandized himself, his position, the court, and the federal government. The most important opinion was how the states understood the definitions given to the states at the time of ratification. In 1821, Mr. John G. Jackson asked James Madison for his notes on the Constitutional Convention. This is because Robert Yates, a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, who wrote notes officially on the convention. However, Yates was only in attendance from May 25th to July 10th, never to return. It became common knowledge that Madison had the most detailed notes on the convention. Consequently, Mr. Jackson requested a copy. Madison points out the biases of the author and possibly his own. As Madison points out these biases, it did not matter what he or anyone else in attendance at the convention understood the Constitution to mean, because he tells Mr. John G. Jackson in his reply back to him, and I quote, "But whatever might have been the opinions entertained in forming the Constitution, it was the duty of all to support it in its true meaning as understood by the nation at the time of ratification. no one felt more obligated than I have done, and there have been few whose ultimate and deliberate opinions on the merits of the Constitution accord in a greater degree than that obligation. Clearly, Madison understood the fundamental tenets of contract law. This is why he insisted on pointing to the states understanding, quote, again, at the time of its ratification. In other words, my friends, at the time when you're making the deal and agreeing, yes, we accept this contract, only those definitions that were provided at that time, only the language in the contract and the language supporting the definitions, clarifications, and so forth, those are the only things that matter. It doesn't matter what an old man babbles in a black robe in a very dark, dingy, stinky courtroom. So whose constitution is it anyway? So the stage or the foundation was set, right? We had established a constitution, and it was clearly defined in the ratification debates. The Constitution was a compact, or in a grander term, a contract, and the stakeholders were the states. To verify this, read Article 7 to see who has to buy into the contract, and read Article 5 to see who has the final say over changes of the Constitution or changes to the contract, which is 3/4 of the states. Bottom line, it's the states who have the ultimate say. It is their contract. Thus, the Constitution falls under contract law and does not create law itself. In other words, as we go on and on and on, we have found these constitutional rulings of this creating this constitutional labyrinth of laws and so forth. Has there ever been a law that has come out of a Verizon contract? No, there's been case decisions, and there have been, you know, problems, and things have been settled because it's either in the contract or it isn't in the contract, or something that's in the contract was improperly placed, you know, because they, you know, didn't do full disclosure. I mean, there are those types of things, but we don't have that issue here. We do not have any of those issues. Only Congress has the power to make laws. And there are two types of laws Congress can make. Laws that apply to the District of Columbia, see Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17. And laws that are in pursuance or congruent with the Constitution, which applies to the Republic. In other words, they can make laws regarding the powers of the militia being regulated and so forth. However, they cannot make laws regarding abortion, regarding health care, regarding energy, regarding, you know, all these facets of commerce and whether a light bulb can produce, a incandescent light bulb or a fluorescent or an LED. They cannot make laws over those types of matters. These laws must be within the confines of the Constitution. So what does laws in pursuance or congruent to the Constitution mean? It means that the laws must be based upon one of the few enumerated powers. To illustrate, when Congress created an act like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, was this act based upon any power enumerated in the Constitution? No. Right, wrong, or indifferent, there is no power delegated to the general government to protect race, color, religion, gender, or national origin. As a matter of fact, the Bill of Rights were restrictions placed on the government that they couldn't pass any of these types of laws. Consequently, this act only applies to the District of Columbia. And unless they move down this path, where they take this act and have 2/3 majority of both houses and then send it to the states for ratifying to making it an amendment, the act is only applicable in the District of Columbia. Well, there's that song. It's the Fanfare for the Common Man. Well, you can tell we're at that point. So we will be back and we'll be plowing forward with more of these concepts regarding nullification and interposition. And we will close on this probably on Friday. But anyway, we'll see. It looks like things are going sideways here. We'll be right back after this. Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so don't make me out being a racist just because I am giving you the contractual and the constitutional position on acts that the federal government has done. I'm only giving you one example, by the way, because they have lots of acts out there, like the ADA. That is unconstitutional as well. Unless the ADA is an amendment, these things have to be amendments. And, you know, I'm forgetting all my amendments, but I know that that was not a particular amendment to the Constitution. And, no, I do not see anything regarding the amendments, you know, lowering the voting age to 18, presidential disability, barring poll taxes, presidential vote for the District of Columbia, limiting presidential terms of office. See, some of these, like the presidential vote for the District of Columbia, that actually creates a conflict within itself. But anyway, so some of these acts that they have passed are unconstitutional outside the District of Columbia. This is a constitutional fact that cannot be sidestepped, and yet we treat this act and many of these others as if it's the law of the land. That is because the federal government believes there are no bounds to what it can do because the states have failed to use their authority over the Constitution and challenge the federal government on this and so many other laws, roles, responsibilities, and powers the federal government has self-created or assumed without following the codified or systematic process in the Article 5 process of the Constitution. Let's focus on the stage or foundation. The Constitution was ratified based on the arguments provided by the proponents who were, quote, selling, close quote, the Constitution without creating definitions and clarifications to the Constitution. the opponents made two attacks. Most were making accusations that there was a need for a Bill of Rights, and another attack was arguing the meaning of clauses or lines meant something else, you know, like the sweeping clause or the necessary and proper clause in Virginia. Consequently, how the proponents or the Federalists defined the lines, such as the necessary and proper clause, became the legal definition moving forward. And these definitions are still valid today. The only problem is that they've been ignoring these things. If one has gone through contract negotiations, the items agreed upon in the negotiations become appendages to the contract. Just like in a divorce decree today, that the parties agree upon with a mediator is legally applicable and appended to the final divorce decree. In other words, this is one way to amend the contract without having to change the contract. To be clear, these definitions and clarifications were set in stone and legally binding back then as they are today. So, the states failed in erecting the barriers because Madison and Hamilton said you got to create barriers. And that was one of the very few things that I think Hamilton said that he was, you know, maybe he just knew that we wouldn't. Either way, and maybe that's why he never pursued real, you know, political positions so that he could go around and make sure that those barriers were never erected. First and foremost, the states failed in protecting themselves from federal government drifting outside the boundaries of the Constitution by making these definitions and clarifications more readily known. They should have made copies of these debates and shared them among themselves because there is no mechanism in the Constitution to allow the federal government to treat states differently as something is defined in one of the ratification debates. That definition applies in all states. There's a thing called the Uniformity Clause that demands that so, that the states have to be treated equally. Furthermore, all new states joining the Union would be given a full copy of these debates so that they too could be valiant guardians of the Constitution. Another way the states failed is they relied too much on the honor of those who went into the new seats and positions in the newly created federal government. No doubt many of those that were there or that were either sent to the Senate or elected to the House of Representatives were the best and the brightest of the states had to offer, and that's the truth. Creating the barriers that Madison and others referred to would have sent a message that those serving in the federal government were not to be trusted. As Madison stated in Federalist Papers number 51, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control on the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. This policy of supplying by opposite and rival interests the defect of better motives might be traced through the whole system of human affairs, private as well as public. And that comes out of Madison's 1788 Federalist Paper 51, paragraphs 3 and 4, for those of you that want to look that up. It is important to point out that there were no, and I mean zero, conflicts in the different debates regarding how the Federalists testified, defined, and clarified the Constitution. Had there been conflict in the different debates, such as in one debate, the Federalists claimed that the Constitution was a living document left to the interpretation of the court and the federal government alone, then this would throw a wrench into the whole making, or this whole thing of making a real mess, of trying to define it, but you have these contradictions of definitions. Overall, the debates were 100% harmonious with each other in defining a limited and enumerated Constitution. thus making very tight boundaries for the federal government in what they could do and how they were to act. The only thing required for the states was to stay vigilant in keeping the federal government in check. In remaining vigilant and relying on these definitions, this would have elevated the awareness of the states of their roles, responsibilities, and powers over the Constitution to keep the federal government in check. It was Alexander Hamilton that said, "We may safely rely on the disposition of the state legislatures to erect barriers against the encroachments of the national authority." This was in Federalist Paper 85 in 1788. Now, even though the framers were, even though the framers knew men were not to be trusted, the states, for whatever reason, never took the precautions mentioned by the framers. So what happened was a large window of opportunity for anyone who had machinations in growing the powers of the federal government, because they weren't being vigilant and holding to the definitions, and they let these guys just hoodwink them and take them down the wrong paths. The courts have done this, our political leaders have done this, and bottom line, they are violating the Constitution, and they're still violating it, and nothing that they can do to actually fix this other than the state step in and say, you've got to get back into the framework. And if you don't, we're going to come and slam you. And there's ways of doing this. Today, the federal government believes that they have no bounds and can do whatever they wish to the states and the people with full immunity. The facts, as we know, are different than what the federal government believes. What do you do? So what do stakeholders do when their compact is being violated? Right? So what do you do when you know that this contract that you've got isn't being honored? How do you fix this? How do we go about saving our butts? Well, I got just barely over a minute. So let's start with this, and let's start with what they don't do. The one thing that is absolutely absurd and is not necessary is trying to amend the Constitution. The problem is compliance, not a defect with the Constitution or the contract. Whether the amendment is initiated by Congress or the states, no amendment written and ratified can obtain compliance to the Constitution. Compliance only comes when the stakeholders are serious enough to use extraordinary measures within the Constitution. Let me get this one last thing in. On to answering the subtitle question, what do stakeholders do when their compact is being violated? In most cases, people and institutions typically go to court to remedy the problem. But the problem is jurisdiction. Who has jurisdiction over things not delegated to the federal government, like healthcare? Remember a few of those citations from above that I mentioned yesterday during the ratification debates actually answer this question. John Marshall, the Chief Justice, later on in the debates, he said, if they were to make laws, Congress were to make laws not warranted by any of the powers enumerated, it would be considered by the judges as an infringement to the Constitution, which they're to guard. They would not consider a law coming under their jurisdiction, and they would kick it out and rule accordingly in protecting the Constitution. Well, we have a bit more to cover, my friends, and so we're going to have to cover this. But as you know, tomorrow being the 4th, we will be back with Dr. Vile, and then Friday we will do the Declaration of Independence, or maybe I'll push that back. I'll let you know on Friday. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.
I am J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.